Here is the morning show interview with City of Sandpoint Mayor Jeremy Grimm and Public Works Director Holly Ellis. Please enjoy the interview in progress.
You know, get engaged. Come on down. Learn what's happening and the decisions that are being made by your elected officials. So tonight we've got a couple significant projects coming forward to the council. Probably the most critical that's affecting people right now is the North Boyer culvert emergency repair, and Holly can speak to that in a second. If you're not aware, if you're going north of the fairgrounds on North Boyer, that road is currently closed due to a culvert failure, and that road is sinking. So Holly and her team are working diligently to get bids and get that repaired, but it's going to take some emergency funding. It wasn't something we had scheduled in the project list, so that's a big one. We also have the parking policy, the paid parking policy. Director Welker, Jason Welker, our planning and community development director, has been working on bringing to the council the concept of a paid parking policy, which, if adopted, would result in some paid parking at City Beach and maybe the city lot, and conceivably even on the streets downtown with meters. So that's one to watch. And then finally, there's a request by myself to redirect revenue from all the recreational facilities back to the general fund. Currently, all that revenue from boat moorage, from the RV, from field rentals, all those sorts of activities goes into the Park Capital Improvements Fund. And with all the needs across the city, I'm asking the council to change that ordinance to allow those revenues to actually go back into the general fund instead of the Park Capital Improvements Fund, so we can consider all of our needs on equal footing, and that money's not just automatically directed to the Parks Improvement Fund. So those are some of the highlights, and we'll see how it all goes.
I have one question about the revenue coming from the parks and recreational extra money coming in from fees. You're not taking away from the current maintenance fund to go to the general fund?
No, so currently the general fund, we get a little over $4 million from property tax a year in the city. And currently the parks department and Parks and Rec gets the largest portion of that. They get $1 million a year. So we're funding parks maintenance through the general fund, but all the revenue that's generated from the parks, which is about $450,000 a year, that doesn't come back to backfill the general fund. It goes into the Park Capital Improvements Plan. And I guess my perspective is we've got an incredible park system here. People appreciate it. It's part of our quality of life. But we've reached a point where we have a lot of other failing infrastructure and needs. And I think we need to balance and take a hard look at what point do we start saying, you know, our parks are in great shape and they're impressive, but we need to start redirecting those dollars towards roads and critical infrastructure.
So in other words, just to clarify, you're not taking money away from parks for the regular maintenance, but just for improvements.
Correct.
Going back into the general fund.
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
How's the Park Capital Fund been used? Is it it's held and used year to year, or does it accumulate over time for some big project like Memorial Field?
Both. In general, it pays for, grant matches. So if we were to get a grant. I'm happy to announce Jason and his team for the RV park retrofit or remodel down at City Beach. For that, we had a $50,000 match for a almost $1 million grant. So oftentimes it'll be used for matches for grants or for specific projects. But for those who are concerned about, you know, are we going to defund the parks? No. Parks also have development impact fees coming in, significant dollars to expand our parks that people pay when they build new homes or new commercial areas. And then finally, these dollars going back to the general fund, it doesn't mean that the council won't allocate them to parks. It just unhandcuffs them and says, lets the council basically weigh if a park capital improvement is of greater priority than a street repair or something like that.
In the year-to-year budgeting
process.
Correct,
in the year-to-year budgeting process.
Thank you.
Well, it raises a couple other parks-related questions here. You know, one is, how does the James Russell Sports Center play into this decision? And right now, you know, as has been reported, it's running in a deficit. Which I wonder if that should have been expected from the start. I wonder if these kind of field houses ever really generate enough revenue for operations.
Right, right. Great question. And that's also on the agenda tonight. I forgot about that one. Director Welker will be presenting an update to the council on basically three options that we talked about a couple weeks ago at a workshop. And those options are basically keep going under the current course, running it as a tennis and pickleball facility. And option two would be bringing in a partner like the U.S. Tennis Association, who has a program through affiliates where they actually help run and program a facility. And then the third option is looking at trying to increase usership and revenue by converting one of the court areas into a multi-surface floor that would allow maybe volleyball, lacrosse, soccer, baseball, football, something like that.
Basketball.
Just basketball. So we could get more users in there and obviously rent that. But to your point, you know, in retrospect, you know, hindsight's 20/20. Most of these types of facilities do not cover 100% of their cost. We're actually doing a pretty good job after Director Welker looked at the revenue and the expenditures. We've had some fits and starts with staff. We've got some great staff in there right now, really passionate about making it work. So, in retrospect, it sure would have been nice to have a good endowment with this facility to ensure maybe build a smaller facility with a larger endowment to help cover those costs. But we're working our way through it and appreciate the patience the public's given us on this.
Mm-hmm. And the good news is it's available and it's being used.
It is being used. It is open. It is available. And I think the big question is, you know, what's the optimal utilization of it? You know, we heard stories at that workshop about many different indoor and field sports that just don't have facilities in the wintertime. So, you know, what I actually heard is we need a second facility. So if anyone has a spare couple million dollars, please feel
more
free
like
to
10,
contact us.
Yeah, 10 million.
Yeah, probably. Yeah, as we saw, that facility was over $7 million.
Yes, yeah, and staff did a great job bringing it in on budget, but yeah, $7.5 million, almost $8 million, and you know, I'll just leave it with this: one of the saddest things and most frustrating things I see living in Sandpoint is on a dark, dreary winter day, seeing kids get out of school. You know, it's pouring rain and they're walking home, and I just know there aren't facilities where they can get out and exercise and meet friends and grow their skills. So, an indoor facility for the youth of our community that's not so limited to just tennis and pickleball is something I would be a huge advocate for. Mm-hmm.
And a shout out to the James Russell family who made this
Absolutely.
Huge donation, one of
Absolutely.
The biggest in state history, I think.
So generous, yeah. So generous. And, you know, they've been incredible partners working through this with us all along the way. And hats off to them. They have been just stalwart partners and supporters of this. So thank you to the Russell family.
Let's stay on parks topics for just another minute, and then I do want to talk about some of the road work that Holly can address as well. So it was actually kind of controversial to remove the lifeguard stands at the city beach. And what was the rationale there?
Yeah, you know, it just is a liability issue. You know, we did some hard work to try to recruit lifeguard staff for the second year. We did analysis of what lifeguards are paid in the region. We actually went far above that. We tried to recruit, you know, becoming a lifeguard is not a flipping a switch. You have to go through training, first aid, and related hours and hours of training. So that really starts in, you know, April. So we needed a full team by April. And despite our efforts and reaching out to the swim team and others, we just couldn't get enough qualified candidates. So, you know, as a result, we don't want to put one or two lifeguards out there. That's a liability because they're watching a whole area. We figured we needed about 12 lifeguards to run the beach. And without them there, those lifeguard stands could, I guess, in some people's eyes, lead them to believe that there's coverage. And so just as a cautious move, I decided to have those removed so that no one thinks that there's lifeguards on duty because they're
the
not.
Idea I think just that's by seeing that.
Really yeah. smart, kind of false advertising.
Right, and, right. In today's litigious idea. World, you can't assume anything. So
one question that I saw posted out there in the social media world on this was, how about the swim team? Aren't those kids on the swim team when they have kind of a natural connection to be lifeguards?
That used to be our feeder. Mike down there did an amazing job, and he's retired. But there used to be a real feeder out of that program. And I was a lifeguard as a teenager. It's a great summer job. But for whatever reason, we just did not see the interest. And it wasn't for a lack of trying. We just didn't see the interest from enough qualified or potentially qualified candidates.
Mm-hmm. One more question on the parks. So the geese are back.
They are.
I was there on Sunday and this huge flock came in and I counted over 50 geese landed on the other side of the pavilion area of the lawn. And they were foraging in the grass.
And pooping.
Yeah, and pooping. So what's the status of the dog patrol?
They are active. We sent out another email chain last week. They are active, trying to increase patrols out there. It appears that it's been successful to date, but these geese are migratory, so they do move around. What I'm happy to see is that we didn't see the breeding, the goslings down there this year. So the hope is that, the more active those patrols get, the more, aware those geese will be that this is not their place. I'm not going to euthanize them. I think we just need to keep pushing forward with the dog patrol. And I really celebrate citizens. I always say, don't come to me with a problem. I hear lots of problems every day. Bring a solution to your concern and happy to work through that. So this was a citizen-initiated solution to a challenge that we have, and I think we just need to give it another year, and we're making progress.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I perceived progress myself. Just there's less goose poop around, mm-hmm. so I think the dogs are definitely having a beneficial effect.
And, this is fun for the dogs, too. I watched a dog in action, and he was having a blast, and the geese left because they didn't like him.
It's very effective.
It worked.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Okay, well, let's get on to some of this road work. As you mentioned, Mayor Graham, North Boyer is closed right now. They're replacing the culvert where Little Sand Creek comes under it, under North Boyer. And that's just a little north of the fairgrounds. And Holly, you can speak to this. What happened there, and then what's the status at this point?
Yes, unfortunately, we have a very old culvert that carries Little Sand Creek under North Boyer Road, just past the fairgrounds, as you mentioned, which is just north of Jenny Lane. If you were headed to Schweitzer today, you would be detoured. So the detour is to Schweitzer to 95 Bronx Road. Schweitzer Mountain Road is open, but you've got a detour around the middle of Boyer there, just north of the fairgrounds. It's an old culvert. It is about 12 by 16 feet. They're called a smushed culvert, so it's not a perfect circle. We can't find record drawings for this culvert. Our estimate is that it's anywhere from 50 to 70 years old, which is about the useful life of a corrugated metal culvert. So it's just getting to the end of its life. It's served its purpose. We were not anticipating that this culvert was going to fail. It was not planned for. We got a call from the county just two Thursdays ago that said, hey, why don't you take a look at your culvert? So we've been monitoring it, and pretty quickly we noticed that the culvert was failing pretty rapidly. So
collapsing?
What we noticed was there was a dip in the road, was the start of it. And when you look at pictures of the culvert, the bottom of the culvert is pretty rusted. It's degrading, deteriorating. It's also deforming. So there's some bumps in the culvert where that corrugated metal is starting to pull apart. There's a lot of movement. It's continuing to move. And so when we saw that the culvert had these heaves in the bottom, the structural integrity was really compromised. Mm-hmm. So what we're suspecting is that there could be some water that's leaking through the culvert and really undermining the structural integrity of that embankment. The worst case scenario would be that the culvert failed entirely and would collapse, and that's a life safety issue. It's also really not good for our downstream. So out of an abundance of safety and caution and trying to preserve this culvert for as long as we can until we can replace it, we close the road, and we really appreciate the public's patience in that detour. It's quite inconvenient. We recognize that, but we're really doing our best to prevent this culvert from failing.
When will you be able to replace it?
We're anticipating several weeks. There's two, it's called critical path items. So the two items that are going to take the longest are procuring that material to replace
the culvert. Which is just like a big
It's a big culvert. Corrugated
like
it'd be pipe.
Like 6 foot. I don't know how big the diameter is, but that stream gets pretty big.
Right now it's a 12 by 18 foot culvert. It's undersized. So we're working with the county. I can't thank the county enough. Matt Mulder and Jason Topp have been hugely helpful. They're going to help us size it to our 100-year storm. They have software and all the hydraulic information that we need. We're also working with JUB engineers to make sure that we size this culvert appropriately. Again, it's undersized, and some of the neighbors can tell you stories about flooding. Mm-hmm. So we're going to order this pipe. The lead time is unknown. So once we know the size, we confirm the size this week is our plan, we'll self-procure that pipe. And lead times can be anywhere from 4 to 6 weeks to 4 to 6 months. Mm-hmm. Our hope is that we can find a pipe that's on the shelf and that we can pull off and go. And then the other piece to it is our permitting. So this is in a waters of the U.S. So we'll have to go through Army Corps permitting, IDWR. And again, we have some really good folks in those departments to make sure that we're doing all the right things for our environment and our community.
So Army Corps is involved because this is a tributary to the lake? Is that?
Absolutely right, into Sand Creek.
Yeah. It's wetlands, and it's a big project.
It's in a flood. Wetlands are adjacent. It is in a floodplain. It connects to Sand Creek, which is a sensitive area as it leads to the Pend'Oreille River.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you can imagine we'll be digging and replacing, you know, riprap on the sides. It's basically, I mean, the site could be eligible for a bridge, but we obviously don't have millions of dollars for a bridge. So, in fact, you know, we didn't plan for this. So I guess the unfortunate part of this is, you know, part of the story of Sandpoint aging infrastructure that's been ignored. Unfortunately, we're going to have to redirect dollars that otherwise would have gone to our streets, which were already very limited. We're going to have to pare back on our street projects this year. Cedar Street, probably. We had planned to do that. That's probably going to get kicked off until next year because we're going to have to use those dollars for this emergency repair.
Are there any government grants or funding or from the infrastructure bill that was pushed through a few years ago, somewhere that you can pull in some revenue to help with this project?
We're looking. Yeah. I reached out to LTAC. They had some emergency dollars years ago, and we're hoping they might still have some funds, but not super hopeful on that front.
Sandpoint's on their own, it sounds like.
I think, you know, and I think that's, I mean, we'll see what happens with the big, beautiful bill. But, you know, if you're aware at all, across the board, federal dollars are being pulled back. And I'm not too optimistic that we're going to keep spending the way we have been and the federal support's going to be there.
Yeah, any of those Biden-era bills right now are kind of on hiatus. I think some of them are involved in court decisions as well. Yeah. Like the money was already appropriated and it should be spent. And that's a function of Congress. But I guess we'll see. Good luck finding some money on that because it's got to be a big project. I'm sure it's going to really divert money from, well, as you mentioned, other
streets projects.
Yeah.
It's not as big as the other project that Holly's working on with me, which is our wastewater treatment plant. That is the biggest focus for Holly today. In fact, later today, we're starting to meet with our bond council. We'll be going out for a bond this fall, asking voters for a very substantial amount of money to go into debt to replace our wastewater treatment plant. So that's another big project that Holly has on her shoulders.
Well, give us the nickel tour of that one, Holly. How much Well, is the are the engineering studies complete? You know exactly what you want to do now with the wastewater treatment plant?
So we picked up this project with our facility plan, which was completed in 2018. So we followed DEQ requirements, which is the Department of Environmental Quality, and they require every facility to have, or every wastewater treatment plant to have a facility plan. And then if you're going to do an improvement, they require a preliminary engineering report. Essentially, it's a high-level feasibility plan to make sure that everything is going to work and you don't go too far into the design and there's a fatal flaw. So it's DEQ's check-in with us. We just completed this preliminary engineering report. It really took the facility plan and took it to the next level and really defined the preliminary design. So what came out of that project, again, our original planning effort was in 2018. Now it's 2025. What's happened? Our facility has continued to deteriorate. None of the structures got any better. They actually worsened. Some of the facilities we thought that we could retrofit and save have now are across that point, and they're now needing more serious repair and actual replacement. So the big takeaway from that preliminary engineering report was that $60 million project that we originally planned for, now that it's post-COVID, it's 7 years later, we're looking at $130 million to replace our wastewater treatment plant, which is going to be a huge challenge for us and our community. We have Keller & Associates doing our design on our preliminary engineering report. They're finalizing that. We're going to take it to the council to approve. The mayor mentioned that today is our bond kickoff meeting. After today, things are going to ramp up and get moving pretty quickly. So you'll see a lot more public engagement on the wastewater treatment plant, a lot of educational opportunities for folks to understand what the improvements are, why they're needed, and what our plan is in the future to phase this. One thing we asked our consultant to do, which was a huge challenge, was to look at not just replacing the plant, but how can we phase it, and how can we phase it flexibly so that we can react to funding. The worst case scenario would be that we'd have to rely entirely on our sewer rates to provide this. So we're going to be looking for loans, grant funding, and any opportunity to help support this project.
Are there some state or federal programs that are kind of dedicated to this sort of infrastructure project?
There were. There are a variety of federal funding streams that 3 years ago were incredibly robust. The Recovery Act and others, there are hundreds of millions of dollars allocated to states for water and sewer projects. Unfortunately, the timing was not perfect. So we are now in a case where, you know, there's almost no federal funding out there. I've been working hard with our congressional delegation, Senator Rich's team, Fulcher's team, and Simpson and others, just really trying to emphasize the criticality of this. Because our rates right now, if you're a single family dwelling, you're paying about $100 a month for sewer. And at those levels, we can afford basically a $60 million project. We're looking at probably $130 million project. So this is going to be a challenge, and we absolutely need to keep working for federal support. And historically, the federal government did fund infrastructure like this. So we're hoping that we can go back to sort of the fundamental aspects of the federal government funding critical infrastructure.
It's always a balance, because you can look at building fees, you know, new structure fees, not getting federal funding, but cities all across the country have the exact same challenges. And so balancing all that and making it feasible, and you don't have a choice coming up here. It's going to be at that, as you say, Holly, critical stage where it's a responsibility, and a legal responsibility, but also environmental and moral, so to speak, to provide that kind of infrastructure to a city.
It is my number one priority for my term as mayor. So we are going to figure out how to make this work. And really, if the community has questions, we'll be putting up a webpage. We'll be doing outreach events, educational workshops. So stay tuned. It'll be coming to the voters this fall.
Have you figured out how much the bond request will be?
You know, we believe it's probably going to be $130 million.
Oh, it is for the entire.
You know, our question is really about phasing. You know, can we, you know, go forward and just do elements of it? It's really challenging. I describe it as trying to change the wings on an airplane while you're flying, because we're not relocating the plant. It's going to be at its existing site. And it still has to function and run as they're replacing the digester and the headworks and the, you know, the disinfection and all those parts of it. So it's cost efficient to do it all at once. Mobilization and other costly aspects of phasing it, we're going to consider that. But we will be presenting this all to the public in an educational forum and framework starting probably next week.
Mm-hmm. One quick question. If the bond passed or went, would you be eligible for a low interest loan to start covering the cost? I mean, are there really friendly loans or maybe no interest loans that the government could carry to make this possible?
There are some. Some of those loans come with additional burdens, such as Davis-Bacon wages. If you don't know what that is, you have to pay a prevailing wage, which is typically higher than what we could get a contractor to do it for. There's BABA, which is Buy America, Build America. Yeah. So you have to use American components and steel and whatnot. And not that we wouldn't want to do that, but some of this
supply
is specialized
chain.
Equipment. Yep. Right. So to answer your question, yes, there are some lower interest loans. And there's also municipal tax-free bonds. So one of the things that if you're wealthy enough to invest in these sort of things, you can buy bonds. We'll go out to the market, and these are tax-free bonds that will be floated out there that people will be investing in our system.
Okay. So it's feasible. It's a big job ahead.
It's massive. Other than the byway, it is the largest public works project that I'm aware of in Bonner County's history.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, and actually, it'll be probably more expensive than the byway, and maybe not in the same dollars, right? Because we've seen
inflated dollars.
Since,
and it's important to understand we do have capacity. It's the INI inflow and infiltration issue. We sit on 300 feet of clay, and when it rains on snow, that water goes down into the clay trenches, and it finds its way into our pipes. We've spent about $10 million trying to seal those pipes and grout them and reduce inflows. But in the spring days, we can see sometimes double the flows that we see on our busiest or our fullest summer days. So it's really
10 times.
10 times. I'm sorry. Thank
that
you.
That sounds more like it.
Yeah. So we have a huge, huge challenge because of the conditions of our soils.
Mm-hmm. Right. If you've just tuned in, we want to remind our listeners, this is 88.5 KRFY, as you know. This is our community radio station, and this is The Morning Show, Wednesday, June 18th. And we're speaking with City of Sandpoint Mayor Jeremy Grimm and Public Works Director Holly Ellis, and we have a whole bunch of city talk things to talk about. If you did not hear the first part of this interview, you can go to our website later in the morning, and it will be on there at krfy.org as a podcast.
Okay, stay on infrastructure for a few more minutes at least. And are there other big road projects that people are going to see and maybe should take into account, potential detours? Or I know that you did some work on Bridge Street last Friday because I was going to launch my boat. I got turned around there. And was that just, I couldn't really tell what happened there. That was.
Yeah, I'll let Holly jump into that. I mean, looking at our road system, if you've been here for a year and a half, you'll know that we did go out for a local option tax to support funding of our roads. We really only have, in a good year, $500,000 from our general fund to put towards roads, and then about another $500,000 from our lodging tax. And that's not enough. Holly can speak to this. We've done an assessment of our pavement. If you've driven around town, it's pretty depressing. Most of our roads are in a very poor or failing state. So, it's terribly expensive to rebuild roads correctly. And we have in excess of, I believe it's north of $50 million worth of road improvements to just bring us to national standards. So it's like spitting in the ocean.
It's only 50 years.
Right. I mean, it's really a conundrum. And I don't know how we're going to solve it, because without a local option tax. So Holly can speak to that. And I will say that I'm planning next fall to bring that local option tax for roads back, because that is paid primarily by visitors and non-city residents. So Holly, feel free to speak to your challenges of the roads.
Yeah, it's a struggle. So the $1 million was what we have budgeted every year. We did an assessment of our streets, I think it was 2018, again, that number. And the recommendation from our street assessment was to put $1 million every year into our streets to maintain the existing condition of our roads. So that means we're not getting better roads. We're not improving the roads. We're maintaining the level of service. And when we look at that report, we look at the recommendations of the projects, their recommendation is to put that money towards roads that are already in good condition. Keep your roads that are good in good condition. And we do that by seal coating to make sure that the oil and the asphalt is preserved. We do that with overlays and chip seals. There's a couple different mechanisms we have. We hear from our community that they're not interested in just keeping our good roads in good condition. They want us to reconstruct those old roads that are deteriorating and potholed. Those reconstruction projects are very costly. So each year we try to take our $1 million budget and then balance it with street preservation and street reconstruction. So we're always kind of behind the eight ball on that. And it is a challenge. It is a challenge. And we're hopeful that in the future we can find more money, perhaps with a local option tax, so that we can dedicate more to roads and balance reconstruction and maintenance.
And this goes back to my ordinance tonight to the council, which is, you know, instead of investing in parks 100%, let's look at some of that park revenue, and is it worthy to consider road projects for that? And that's a council decision with the budget, but it's super challenging. The big projects that we do have planned this year, we'll be doing some work on North Division from Farm and Stidwell up to Baldy Mountain. And then we'll be doing Pine Street, a resurfacing of that, and a couple of other minor projects. We were planning to do Cedar between Division and Lincoln. That was budgeted, but with this culvert fiasco, we're going to have to delay that a year.
What I thought was really interesting last time you were here, Holly, how much it takes to do, let's say, a quarter mile or two blocks because of the unique understructure to replace. I'm talking about to replace, I'll say, Main from Division to Ella. It would be another one you could put on the list. Anyone who drives around Sandpoint has their pet road that needs replacing. But there's a unique quality to the sand and the underlaying of our community. The structure.
Oh, absolutely. We're on sitting on clay, as the mayor mentioned before, and that's really not a good surface for a road. There's a lot of movement. It holds water, so it doesn't allow the street to drain. So when the clay holds water, there's a lot of movement, which is not—it's just not good for your roads that are a little more rigid, and you don't want them moving so much. And then in the wintertime, we also have an issue with our freeze-thaw.
So if you're totally replacing a road or reconstructing it, you would think about taking that clay off and putting a different structure in. That's expensive. So how much does it cost to do, say, two city blocks? About
reconstruction, if we are going to do the full reconstruction of that road, probably $400,000. Right. I'm taking our Cedar Street project just for the road. That's five blocks. That's between, the Cedar Street project is between Lincoln and Division. And our engineers are estimating $1 million. That's just five blocks of a reconstructed road.
And that's going to be put off this year because
of
the culvert.
Sucking up the money.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, I just want to emphasize this, you know, just like a household, you know, we have to balance our budget. And it's really a question we've reached of values and priorities. And we have an amazing park system. It's incredibly expensive to maintain. It adds tremendously to our quality of life here. But, you know, at this point, I've heard from a lot of folks that they're happy with the parks. They don't need new expanded parks. Let's start working on our roads and our core infrastructure. So that's the direction I'm encouraging the council to explore.
Okay, well, let's jump on to another topic. So there are a pair of apartments that are proposed to be built on Church Street between 4th and 5th Avenues. First of all, what's the status of that right now? I know that the Planning Commission approved that. Does that come before the council?
It does not come before the council. We have provided a written decision of approval of that project. We had a public hearing on it. At this point, the private property owner has the ability to proceed pending any appeals. There's been a lot of conversation about the parking for this this project. It does fall within our downtown no parking required zone, and that's caused many people to be concerned about the availability of parking. Now, I'll just state, Heartbeats downtown is critical. Getting people to live downtown 24 hours a day, to shop, to meet people, to visit entertainment venues, to work. This is what makes downtowns vital. Saturday night, one of our bigger days in the summer here, we had the Chafe, we had the No Kings protest, we had lots going on. I drove around downtown at 6 o'clock p.m., and on every block except for First, there was ample parking. So there's this perception that we don't have parking downtown, and the reality is we have data, we have photographs, we have drone studies. We have parking within the downtown core, over 500 excess parking spaces, and that's on our busiest farmer market summer days. So we do have parking, and this private property owner, we can't change the rules. The rules are that you don't have to provide parking, and that was very purposeful. That was to eliminate the cost and the barriers for people to invest in our downtown. Since that policy's been in place, we've seen Coachava be retrofitted. We've seen McDuff's. We've seen the winery. We've seen the Hive. None of those places could have been retrofitted or remodeled if they had to meet the parking standards, because typically cities go to this book, and it's a national book of how much parking do you need for a space or a use. And typically, those parking requirements are fairly excessive. So by eliminating the parking parking requirements downtown, we've allowed folks to reinvest in our downtown. And if you're like me and you're here in 2008 and 9, you know that a downturn can be pretty scary downtown with a lot of vacancies. So I just want to make sure that our downtown has every incentive and every ability we can put towards supporting investment in the downtown.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, on this topic, we received a question emailed in that somebody knew that you were going to be here on the radio this morning. And this is from a resident of Sandpoint, lives on Church Street a couple blocks, west of where the apartments will go in. So they're, I'm sure, anticipating impacts as people park down Church Street that might be living there. And the question is, it actually goes to the kind of the question, where do we go from here? What I'd like to know is, when this ordinance was put into place and you were city planner, did you ever envision the scale of this impact? It seems the ordinance was created to help small businesses locate downtown. It is difficult to see how this is not a case of something perhaps meeting the letter of the law, but certainly not the intent, with outcome being detrimental to the quality of life in Sandpoint for both business downtown and homeowners. So I guess the question is this ordinance going to be changed where a bit of commercial enterprise downtown does not have to provide any parking?
The short answer is yes. Director Welker is working on a modification that's going through Planning Commission. We'll come to the council to change some of the requirements. Instead of no parking, it's going to provide the opportunity to pay in lieu. The number is unknown at this point. So if you're going to build, instead of providing that on-site parking, you would pay an in-lieu fee that would be held by the city to go towards an eventual parking structure. you know, a parking structure is probably $30 million. I've said this many times. You don't want to build a parking structure when you have 500 empty spaces on your streets, because you're going to have to pay for that parking structure. And to pay for it, you need people to use it. So when you have 500 empty parking spots downtown, who's going to pay $5 or $10 a day to park in a parking structure? So you need something called parking stress. You need to make sure that there's the right amount of availability, but also enough constraints that people are going to pay to use the parking structure. We're not there yet. We have over 500 available parking spaces downtown. I really, anyone who thinks I'm crazy or this policy is crazy, please drive downtown on an evening between 6 o'clock and 9 o'clock, and you will see parking everywhere. There is so much available parking. It's a literal ghost town most nights downtown. So I'm not worried about parking. I don't think it's going to affect quality of life. I think it's actually a very good thing for a community when you actually have to park and walk to your destination a block or two, because when you're walking from your parking space, say you're parking at the ITD parking lot on the west side of Fifth, which is free, you're going to walk, maybe bump into a neighbor, maybe bump into the mayor, maybe bump into Holly or Chris or Susie. You're going to have an opportunity to have a conversation. You might walk around a storefront and see an item for sale, a book in the window that you want to read. You might see new things going on. So people walking downtown from parking to destination is a good thing. And then finally, I'll leave it at this. Most of the people living in this potential development will be working. So they will probably, if they're not working downtown, they will be working outside of downtown. And then when they come back to live, they'll be coming downtown in the evening when we have ample parking. So did the ordinance consider, something of this scale? I think I did consider that when I developed that ordinance. And I guess my point is I would take 2 or 3 or 4 of these projects, because putting people living downtown is the best thing you can do for the vibrancy and the retailers and the businesses downtown. I'll leave it with that.
So you mentioned one more question on this before we go on to, I would talk about parking more generally, but where does an appeal originate in this kind of project?
Yeah, so you would have to be an affected party, and that's an arbitrary decision of the Supreme Court of whether you're affected or not. I don't think you can live outside the immediate area and call yourself an affected party. And then they would have to file an appeal with the city. And then the council could consider that appeal, and then it goes on from there. So okay. I would suggest anyone who wants to spend their money trying to appeal this, seek legal counsel.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about parking more generally. The parking plan that Jason Walker, the community development director, has been working on, how close is that to being complete? And, you know, there is, of course, a big question everybody has, like, when will paid parking be instituted if this plan gets approved?
Yeah, so it's a two-phase approach. Tonight, the council will consider the parking policy, which is sort of the framework of where and how and what this would look like. If the council is supportive of the adopting the parking policy, we then can confidently spend the time and energy on soliciting vendors. What's the technology that's going to be used? There's all sorts of new technology to make frictionless parking. Like if you go down to Coeur d'Alene and you park down there, you just, you know, take a picture of the QR code on your camera or enter your license plate, and it automatically, you know, validates you. So we'll find the technology. We'll then work on the actual specifics of where we're going to deploy this. Right now, we're thinking City Beach and the city parking lot, potentially on First Avenue and Cedar with parking meters like we used to have. And then we'll talk about the actual fee for a parking pass. And right now, I mean, before anyone gets too excited, we're talking about a very low annual fee. This is going to be, you know, a couple dollars a month that will get you a pass where you can park for between 4 and 6 hours at the beach or downtown. And then finally, if you're a resident living downtown, there'll be an opportunity to buy a monthly or annual residence pass. So altogether, that parking revenue will help shore up the city's budget and make sure that when these parking facilities fail in the future, we can replace them, and also to do some other things, maybe like fund the spot bus, which we're also quite challenged right now to fund that.
Mm-hmm. And that does help with the parking situation if people take the bus and they need to bring their car down.
Spot is a great, great service that does reduce the amount of parking required downtown.
Mm-hmm. And what gets approved tonight if the council does decide to approve something? Is it actually, are there numbers and you know, areas? It's going to lay out a map that shows the areas that would be to have different time periods that you can park there?
There is a plan. It's a policy that discusses all of those things. Each year the city adopts in the summer a fee schedule for the coming year. So those rates and those fees are set during that fee adoption hearing. So we'll have some preliminary numbers in there. And then at the actual adoption of the fee schedule, that's when those final numbers will come in. But we don't anticipate any paid parking happening until next summer.
Well, I'm going to throw this out there before we move on, because I just got a text from someone, but try to find those 500 parking spaces during the day when people are working downtown and patronizing the stores and restaurants.
Yeah, great comment. I tell you what, whoever sent that, let's meet at 12 o'clock in front of iCarts. I'll be standing there at 12, and I will take you on a tour, and I will show you many, many parking spaces within 3 blocks of downtown. Yeah. So
today,
whoever you are today, 12 o'clock in front of iCarts, we will okay. We'll jump in the car and I'll
show
you.
The mayor's challenge.
Please, whoever you are. So
okay.
I'll be there.
So we'll see if this individual shows up.
Put it in my calendar right now.
Yeah. We're going to run out of time in just a minute or two. So what else would you like to let people know about that's open mic here?
You know, I guess I'd just like to convey that, you know, we are so lucky to live in a community where the public can have discourse and communication. We all have different points of view. I want to reflect on this last Saturday. There is the No Kings protest. We had hundreds and hundreds of people on both sides of the perspective, and I was pretty nervous that day. It's not fun to be prepared for a unfortunate event.
Possible violence.
I just want to thank the Sandpoint Police, Bonner County Sheriff, everyone who made that event respectful. You know, passions were high. We all celebrate our rights as Americans to have freedom of speech and many other constitutional rights, such as the Second Amendment. And, you know, it really reflects our community. We had a showing where people disagreed, but it didn't get out of hand. And I just want to say thank you to everyone for, you know, being American and really valuing the ability to disagree and express yourself without resorting to violence or other things. So that's the big thing. And then, you know, from the city perspective, we deal with a lot of issues. I know we spend a lot of time on the Russell Center and parks, but just keep in mind that the staff and the department heads are juggling a lot. You know, it's a $50 million plus dollar budget. We are running 2 utilities, the water, the sewer. Holly's managing the wastewater, the water, the roads. We've got building activity going on. You know, if you think being at City Hall is a cush job, it's not. It's intense. There's fires and challenges every day, but we're all there to serve the public and be good stewards of your tax dollars. So just appreciate the overwhelming support that I get and our staff gets for the work that's done. And with that, we've got, you know, a few other things that we're working on. We do have a water challenge that the public should be aware of. It's not a quantity of water. It is a transmission of water issue. This is my second priority that I'm working on, and it primarily has to do with the distribution of water towards the end of the system. As you get further from Sandpoint, those pipes have to, provide something called fire flow. And especially in the area of Ponderay and Kootenai and outlying areas of unincorporated Bonner County, Ponder Point, we have very small pipes out there. And those pipes don't adequately transmit water sufficiently. So we're seeing some applications for projects and growth outside the city in an area that we serve water. And it's a case-by-case situation right now, whether or not we can serve that. If we don't have fire flows, we can't react to a fire. And if we all remember what happened down in LA and Malibu this winter. It's not a question of if, but when we have a big fire in this area. We've been very lucky since 1910. But that is a huge concern of mine. How do we come up with an equitable way to expand the system outside of city limits? So I'm going to be working with the mayors of Ponderay and Kootenai, and we're going to be trying to figure out what is the right path to make sure that we can upsize those pipes and who's going to pay for that upsizing. So that's a big challenge that the public should be aware of right now.
And that feeds systems like Ponderay or Northside Water, right?
We serve several. We have some wholesale customers. If you're west of town, you're probably served by Syringa. We wholesale water to them. They maintain their pipes. They do their readings. They do their billings. We do the same with Northside. But Ponderay, Kootenai, and Ponder Point, Sandpoint does the engineering, the approvals, the meter reading, all of the repairs. And the challenge for us is we don't control the land use. So we're asked to extend water lines, but we don't have any clear ability to govern whether it's going to be commercial or high density or low density. So it gets really challenging to design and plan for a system when you don't control the land use. And the horse is out of the barn. We decided to extend water out of the city limits many, many years ago. I think in retrospect, that was a poor decision. And I'm going to be working to try to corral that horse and figure out a way that we can equitably share the cost for expanding the water system outside the city of Sandpoint. Mm-hmm.
I think City Talk should be a two-hour program next time. There is a lot going on, and you are not a mayor in name only. You're not a figurehead. You're very involved, and Holly, the work you're doing is a lot. So thank you for that service into our community. And what else, Chris?
Well, with that, we're just about out of time. Yeah. Susie, any last 3-minute announcements you want to make?
Yeah, while we're here, this Sunday we have the Fourth Sunday Showtime coming up with host Don Childress. That's from 5 to 7, Sunday, June 22nd. He will be featuring the Broadway musical called Some Like It Hot. And tomorrow on the morning show, we have Jack Peterson. We'll be talking with Michelle Murphy and Debbie Love about a project through the food bank called Produce Project. And we don't know who we're going to have next week, but we'll let everyone know.
Well, we like to stay loose, so when things pop up, we can be
timely about it. You guys can come back. I think we have a lot more to cover.
I want to mention that I went to the Little Live Radio Hour that KRFY puts on last night, and it was terrific. Ten String Smile played, and I don't know if people tuned in to hear that, because that's the whole idea. You can hear it over the airwaves.
It's a live concert in your living room.
Or you can go to the Little Panda Theater and take it in. And it was actually a completely full room. Yeah.
Oh, that's good. Yeah. A live studio audience, which is always fun.
Yeah. Nice.
And music was great.
And that's once a month on the third Tuesday of the month.
Yes.
Well, you're welcome to come down to City Hall. We could set you up with a little booth in the hallway, and you could do live coverage of our council meetings.
Which is tonight, by the way.
Tonight, 5:30. We love public engagement. We love public being aware. And if you do have problems, I always say this, but please let me know your concerns, but try to bring a solution, because I don't have all the answers, and it takes some collective thought on these things. So just appreciate the public support, and we're moving in the right direction.
Thank you, Mayor Graham. And again, Public Works Director Holly Ellis.